Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This is the Northern Panel of the Supreme Court. We're hoping that someday to change the name to the Nevada Panel, since we hear all the cases from Washoe as a panel and the rural cases, and then we do overflow of Clark County. And my friend Justice Gibbons came up with the idea that when we have Clark County cases, that it's a good idea to come down here so you folks can bring your litigants if you want. The parties can come if they want. And well, the reality is, if you have a case in Carson City where we normally would have the case, you'd have to fly up, and I understand it's freezing up there and it's icy. So we're doing this to safeguard the integrity of this whole process, to make it fair for the attorneys in Clark County, the litigants in Clark County. So that's, I thank Justice Gibbons for coming up with this idea. This first case today is case number 51562, Hamler versus State. Mr. Westbrook, on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you and good morning, Justices of the Court. May it please the Court, my name is David Westbrook. I'm a member of the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and it's
my honor.
Excuse
me for 1 second, Mr. Westbrook.
Oh, let me announce that, too. Justice Seda is also on our panel and is unavailable today. She will listen to this oral argument, though, when we conference on this case and when we come up with a disposition, so that everybody knows. She will be up to date on this case.
Thank you,
Your Honor. She's excused today.
And I would send my greetings to Justice Seda as well.
Thanks.
I represent Ronald Hamler, the appellant in this case. When you do enough trials, you sometimes get an idea of where your jury is going, and sometimes you get an idea about a particular juror. And in this case, that particular juror that we had an idea about was juror number 3. May I pause for a moment?
Yeah, we got it off? You can go ahead.
Okay, thank you. When this was back as a unanimous verdict, we were shocked. And when we asked to poll the jury, it was not some pro forma request, as it often is. It's because we could not believe juror number 3 would vote guilty in the case. We just had a feeling, and attorney's hunch is only worth so much, but that was our hunch. And so when we polled the jury, and we got to juror number 3, and she was asked the question, juror number 3, is that your verdict is read? She did not answer, despite what the transcript says, and I'll be asking to supplement the record later with the actual jabs, which shows this conclusively. She did not answer. She shook her head no, which we made a record of, and she hid her head in her hands, and she sobbed. And then juror number 9, not hearing an answer, thought it was her turn to talk and said yes. And then the court moved on to juror number 4. Now, the fact that the court then re-polled her immediately upon getting her equivocal response is error enough to overturn this verdict under Bishop, which is a case that we cited, where a juror said reluctantly yes, or worse to that effect, when polled. The proper course at that point would be to send them back to deliberate, but instead she was said, juror number 3, is that your verdict is read? And then she changed her answer again from a head nod and a sob. She said no with her body language and sobbing to a yes. And then there was a subsequent polling, and again she said yes. But at that point, the inherent pressure of the situation made it so we can't trust her verdict, and there was not a real verdict in this case. Regardless, I want to talk today, for the most part, about the reasons why this juror feels, as we do, that there was not sufficient evidence in this case, and that Mr. Hamler was not guilty, and that this is an erroneous verdict that needs to be overturned. This case was flawed from the very start, and it started in justice court when a district attorney raised her hand and swore an oath that she could not proceed because she had an indispensable witness who was not there. That indispensable witness, that witness that caused the court to waive our client's rights to a speedy preliminary hearing and to continue the case, was somebody who was so unimportant that that person was not presented at the next preliminary hearing date, and I was not presented in the trial. Hill and Bustos have been around for a long time, and for the last, certainly ever since I've been practicing, but really for the last 20 years, the exception of one case in 97, which was a juvenile case that I recall, there hasn't been a lot written about it. And because of that, courts are ignoring it. They're ignoring it. People are getting these continuances in justice court, not because they stand up and they show good cause for them. They're getting them because it's a courtesy. A courtesy. In fact, courts have said, it's a courtesy, it's my policy to give everybody one continuance. In this case, we took it up on a writ to the district court, and the impression of the district court was, I don't even want to hear argument on this. In fact, when Mr. Waters, who was sitting at counsel table today, argued the writ, he was told, sit down. And he heard the clinking of handcuffs behind him when he was told in Judge Mosley's court to sit down. So not only is the law not being upheld and being respected, and not only is raising your hand as a district attorney and swearing an oath not being given any meaning whatsoever, we're not even being allowed to really argue it, and we were not allowed to argue it in this case. We were told to sit down. The law needs to be updated. It needs to be reaffirmed, and we would request an opinion on that, and dismissal in this case, because there has to be some kind of meaning when someone stands up and raises their hand and swears an oath. If not, raising the hand is meaningless, and our entire system is meaningless.
Mr. Westbrook, and I know that's an important issue, and we understand that. We also have a lot of other issues as well. If I could maybe direct you to one, if
please.
You could talk about on the issue of bias and the cross-examination regarding the bias of Mr. Ferris towards African-Americans and the restriction on that cross-examination and how it impacts the case of Ramsey versus State, 100 Nevada 277 on that, and your thoughts on that. And I'd like to hear from the state on that as well.
Well, Your Honor, Ramsey and all the cases we cited, I mean, starting way back at Davis v. Alaska, says we get to present a defense. And bias is always, it's never collateral, it's always relevant. And in this case, we're trying to establish a few things by getting into his prior acts of accusing black men of robbing him. First of all, he develops a necessity for making such a claim. He makes a false claim, and he always chooses black men. Either it's because it's some kind of a prejudice within him, which is something we wanted to explore and we're not able to, or it's because he recognizes a prejudice with law enforcement and realizes that him, as a white man, as a white disabled man, he's deaf or partially deaf, he'll be believed if he says a black man robbed him. These prior allegations, and this was the third consecutive year, this case, the Hamler case, was the third anniversary of his annual attempt to blame a black man for robbing him, to whatever end. We wanted to explore that, and it had nothing to do with dragging him through the mud. It had nothing to do with some kind of a bad actor character argument. We had the right and the obligation to explore him for bias.
Well, let me ask you, in Ramsey, that opinion would be consistent with your argument here. However, they affirmed the conviction and said the error was harmless because of the other evidence of guilt. You know, there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt.
And they were absolutely right to do that in Ramsey. There was overwhelming evidence in Ramsey.
What about this case?
In this case, not at all. First of all, and we asked the officer this. The officer agrees with us on this. Detective Kane will agree with this, even though he's not here today. He's never seen a case of self-defense, which is what this was couched as by the state, where the perpetrator was stabbed in the back twice, and where the perpetrator, the man that Mr. Ferris was supposedly defending himself against, had defensive wounds on his hands and his arms, stab wounds in his back. This is a very close case, and this case came down to a piece of evidence that was destroyed by the state, and that's the laptop. There's absolutely no way that this can be harmless error in this case because it was so close. Juror number 3 certainly thought it was close. She thought it enough to shake her head no when asked if it was her verdict and to begin sobbing in the courtroom openly. This is a very close case. In fact, had Mr. Hamler called the police first, it's entirely possible that I would be the defense attorney for Mr. Ferris in the attempted murder case of Ronald Hamler.
So your position is the state's case rested primarily upon Mr. Ferris' testimony and as opposed to other independent evidence to corroborate their case.
Well, the way it worked out and their lack of preservation of evidence, it rested entirely on Mr. Ferris' testimony. Mr. Ferris' self-serving testimony, the testimony that he gave because he knew that if it was found out that he was doing drugs in public housing, he would have been evicted. Another topic we were not allowed to fully explore and were shut down when we tried to do it. Bias and motive, always relevant. Furthermore, in destroying this laptop, the laptop is the basis for the robbery. The claim is that Mr. Hamler came in there, took the laptop, and began trying to escape with it, and that's when he was stabbed in the back and stabbed in the arms and stabbed in the hand. Now, I don't know how he didn't drop that laptop. Adrian Peterson fumbles every time he gets hit, but somehow Ronald Hamler was able to run out of an apartment with knife wounds and dripping blood everywhere and retain that laptop. Really impossible to believe.
It's a good thing Justice Chair and I aren't Viking fans. So
I should have researched that before saying that. I apologize to the state of Minnesota. Regardless, though, there was so much blood that they were able to follow a Hansel and Gretel-like trail of it all the way from the front door of Mr. Ferris's project house to Mr. Hamler's apartment. There was a ton of blood. He was seriously injured from the knife wounds in his back, his hands, and his arm. So our theory of the defense was that this laptop was not stolen. It was given to him earlier in the day in exchange for money and or drugs, or to buy drugs. It was given as safekeeping. That's the reason why Mr. Ferris still had the cords in his house. You keep the cords, I'll take the laptop. Okay. If there is no blood on that laptop, then obviously Mr. Ferris's entire theory of events is completely undercut. If there's no blood on that laptop, then we're not here today. Mr. Hamler is acquitted. And that's all there is to it. So what did the police do? They went and got the laptop. They saw some drops of something on it. That something was red, bright red, in fact. So they took pictures of it. Now, the standard of review for determining whether or not the laptop was important was... I'm going to make sure I state it correctly. A standard of review, and this is under Sanborn and all of its progeny, if the defendant shows either that the state acted in bad faith or that the defendant suffered undue prejudice and the exculpatory value of the evidence was apparent before it was lost or destroyed, then it warrants reversal in this case. They knew that it was important. That's why they took a picture of it. Okay, but they destroyed that evidence the next day. They didn't give it the chance to test it, and then the state proceeded to argue the entire trial that there was blood on that laptop. Despite rulings from the court against them doing that, they did it time and time again. And I'm getting close to the time for my rebuttal, but I do want to read something and remind the court of the Glover case that was just decided. Now, it wasn't quoted in our brief because it came out after briefing was done. But in Glover, a public defender said something about some evidence that hadn't been introduced. A tape recording, as you all, I'm sure, recall.
Right.
Okay? And it was determined that that was so incendiary and so poisoned the trial that it was okay for a mistrial, that a mistrial was appropriate.
By the majority, not by the
state. No, the majority held that it.
The majority certainly affirmed.
It's 4-3 case. Course, so.
4-3, that's true. But I think what happened in that case, despite the fact that we certainly didn't like the outcome over to the public defender's office, what we do like is this. Clearly, I think the state of Nevada is trying to pay more attention to prosecutorial misconduct, and all kinds of misconduct, by all attorneys, by defense attorneys too, obviously. Mm-hmm. If the goal of the state of Nevada is to give more credence to misconduct and how it affects a jury, then how can we have a situation where the state destroys evidence, the police destroy this evidence, and then they go into a trial and on numerous occasions talk about that evidence and classify it as blood, when we don't know it's blood? There's no evidence that it's blood. They know there's no evidence it's blood, and they're responsible for destroying it. And it's not just a few times. The detective talks about it as blood, and then we get this ruling, which is completely ineffectual. You can call it a blood-like substance. That's almost like saying, well, the defense is right on a technicality jury, so we're going to call it a blood-like substance, even though we all know it's blood. That's the effect of it. And in closing argument, after being told time and again, don't call it blood, we have Mr. Scow saying the following. It's on page 573 of volume 2 of our appendix. I'm sorry, page 550 of volume 2 of the appendix. And as you look, I'm quoting him now, and as you look closely at the laptop, and you'll have this picture, if you look closely here, along the side, and this in the back, the very back portion, she's showing pictures to the jury. We'll get a closer shot right here, but you see here, up here, those are blood marks on that laptop. He says that to the jury. He testifies what the evidence is, even though there is no evidence in the case. That has to infect it. It has to infect the trial. And if Glover means anything, it means that we must reverse here.
Thank you. You want to reserve your 2.5 minutes?
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Sedlock, on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office representing the state of Nevada.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm sorry, that's it. Thank you.
I was trial counsel on this case, and I am going to be arguing the matter this morning. I would like to start by saying, at this point, the trial was very contentious. There were a lot of pre-trial rulings and determinations made by the judge. Both Judge Mosley and Judge Barker, who actually ended up hearing the matter, throughout the trial, throughout the actual trial and pre-trial, there were a lot of assertions made by defense counsel that the victim was making all of this, the statements and his view of what happened. He was making all of it up. There was no evidence at trial to show that that was actually the case, that the victim had fabricated any of this. Now, counsel stands up here and argues there were police reports, and this was referenced in the record, that they tried to introduce two police reports, one from 2005, one from 2006, where Mr. Ferris, the victim in the instant case, had filed police reports claiming that he was a victim. We objected, Your Honor, Justices, at trial for any of that evidence coming in. And we did so because that essentially, the defense was trying to use it as bad act evidence. There was no Petrocelli hearing done. Under the rules of trial, they were not allowed to get into that evidence. It did not go to bias. It did not go to motive. A victim in 2007, it's irrelevant whether he was a victim in 2006 and in 2005. It just was not relevant. Judge Barker made that determination, and defense was just not allowed to go there, and I believe that was the proper ruling by Judge Barker. Furthermore, defense tried to introduce evidence, or wanted to introduce evidence, of misdemeanor convictions, misdemeanor arrests. They were not allowed to do so because they were precluded from doing so by the rules of evidence. They were allowed to cross-examine the victim in abundance. They were allowed to cross-examine and actually call the detective, who the state chose not to call as a state's witness, to the stand and cross-examine, or direct him to get to the victim's bias. There just was not evidence of any bias by this victim against black male adults. It just wasn't there, Justices. And that's why Judge Barker, I believe, made the proper ruling when he did sustain the state's objection as to introducing any evidence of that.
I guess he didn't watch the Simpson trial in Los Angeles, where Mark Furman is allowed to be cross-examined about his racial bias.
And Your Honor, in this case, and I believe Ramsey is somewhat on point, in that case, the court found that it was harmless error. I would ask, or I would submit, even if you found that the defense was entitled to cross-examine a victim, essentially to get him on the stand to say, you've been a victim before, and you made all of that up before, and there was no evidence that Mr. Ferris had made up any of that, had fabricated any of that, even if defense was allowed to cross-examine him on these previous allegations against black male adults, the error in this case would be harmless.
I mean, it sounds to me, what counsel argued was it's your case rested primarily on the testimony of Mr. Ferris. There wasn't like a lot of other evidence there, so it's like one word against another.
And Justice, I would, with all due respect, disagree. There was other evidence. In fact, there was overwhelming evidence.
Okay, tell me about what was it.
Well, first, let me start out by saying this was, in a way, one man's word against the other, because the crime was committed in the victim's home. Mm-hmm. It wasn't committed out in the open. Most crimes aren't. Defendants are probably smart enough to recognize that. So this crime was committed in the victim's home. Separate and apart from the victim's statements to both officers, detectives, and to the jury, who came back with a unanimous verdict, whether or not defense wants to say now that one of the victims was sobbing, that just is not my recollection, was not in the record. Separate and apart from the victim's testimony, we had the testimony of a neighbor, Katharita Coleman, who testified in front of the jury that prior to the defendant leaving her residence and walking across to come into contact or contact the victim, he told her, I'm going to go get him. I'm going to go get Rick. Which, in turn, what you look at what the defendant actually did, well, he went and he got Rick. He got Mr. Hamler. He got Mr. Ferris. He robbed him of the laptop. He beat him with a frying pan, causing a pretty substantial dent in that frying pan. And separate and apart from Mr. Coleman's from Ms. Coleman's testimony. We also had the laptop that was found in the defendant's possession. When he spoke with officers post-Miranda, he gave not one story, not one version of what had happened the night of the robbery and the battery, but he gave a second version and a third version, and ultimately he led officers to where they recovered Mr. Ferris's laptop in the defendant's possession. So that, Justice, I would argue, is overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. He, in fact, led the officers, walked with the officers to where they then recovered the laptop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. I would also like to address the issue of Bustos in this case, which was made at the lower level in Justice Court. I did not originally have the case. Another deputy from my office obviously handled the matter for preliminary hearing. She felt one of the witnesses who was not present was an essential witness. She also at that time did not have the ability to communicate with the victim who was present for preliminary hearing because, as Your Honor, as your justices are aware, he was hearing impaired. She did not have the way to pretrial that witness. At that point, she felt, in her opinion, this other witness was essential. Under Egan versus Sheriff, the law is clear. The law is clear that a determination made essentially by one deputy that a witness is essential does not bind then my hands to calling that witness or then determining whether or not he is essential for both the preliminary hearing or further on down the road at trial. I put the preliminary hearing on having had the opportunity to pretrial my victim with the use of the court interpreter and the victim's mom. And I felt at the end of my presentation of the victim's testimony at preliminary hearing, I had met my burden of proof. At that point, I chose to rest. The court agreed with me, bound the defendant up over to district court. So I don't believe that Bustos needs to be readdressed. Egan needs to be addressed. The law is clear, and the law was followed in this case, and it was affirmed by both Judge Mosley and Judge Barker. And I take offense with Mr. Westbrook's argument before the court this morning to say that Judge Mosley yelled at Mr. Waters and told him to sit down. That happened. It absolutely happened. But it happened after a very long, drawn-out argument. And I'm not trying to, I will not make myself a witness in this case, but I will tell you that happened. But Mr. Waters and Mr. Westbrook both put on the record the matters that they needed to put on record, and Judge Mosley decided he had had enough at that point and made his ruling, which was then again affirmed by Judge Barker. So I don't believe that there's an issue of a Bustos violation or any of the Brady violations cited to in appellant's brief. And I would like to address the failure to preserve the laptop in this case. There's a whole lot of issue made about whether or not police officers should have preserved the evidence. Well, I would draw an analogy to the laptop in this case. It's like a stolen vehicle, which officers recover all the time, which are always after preliminary investigation is done, unless there's substantial evidentiary value, drugs found in the car, a dead body found in the car. These vehicles, when it's solely a possession of a stolen vehicle case, they're returned to the victim. Why? Because the victims need their vehicles. And in this case, similarly, the laptop was returned to Mr. Ferris because it was at that time his only form of communication. The only way he had of communicating with the outside world, including his mother, was one, with his cell phone, not actually communicating verbally, but texting. That cell phone was lost about a week or at least a couple of days prior to the defendant stealing the victim's laptop. At this point, at the time of the robbery, the victim's sole means of communication was that laptop.
What about the blood issues counsel talks about there?
And Your Honor, I would argue that the standard is that the state acted in bad faith. That clearly was not the case. It was not the situation. The officers followed normal practices, and the courts have found when officers follow normal practices, that is good faith. So it's not enough to show or to hope for a conclusion. Had we had the computer, had we had it tested, it would have shown that it wasn't blood, or it was, or so, was someone else's blood. That's just not the standard.
But you're creating a double standard here. That you can, it's like you have your cake and eat it too. In other words, it's wonderful that you returned it to a hearing impaired alleged victim, but then to have what the defense considers prosecutor misconduct about that particular piece of evidence. Why would the attorney who handled the case do that and violate our rules on prosecutorial misconduct?
And, Your Honor, just so I can ask for clarification, are you referring to the closing argument?
Yeah.
Yes, Judge. And it was made apparent throughout the trial that the laptop was not tested. That was made clear to the jury by both the court, by counsel, by cross-examination. That was made clear. And I believe in closing, perhaps the deputy who was making that closing argument, he left out the blood-like substance or the red substance. But it was clear at that point to the jury that the laptop had not been tested. And I would argue, or I would submit, that that was relevant, that there was some red blood-like substance on that laptop, not necessarily to show that that was in fact blood, because I couldn't argue that it was or wasn't because it was never tested, but it was relevant because it corroborated other evidence in this case, which was the trail of red blood-like substance leading from the victim's residence after the robbery to where the defendant was staying, to the defendant's residence.
I would suggest that the district attorney's office test things like this before they release any type of evidence. And sure if a car had valuable evidence in it, you wouldn't release the car no matter what. So, and I can see that a car is different than a vehicle, certainly different than a computer. But certainly victim witness could have supplied a different computer to this man as the alleged victim. So you got to tell me, why would this be harmless error if I consider that error on the prosecutor's misconduct?
And Justice, I wouldn't disagree with you in that the laptop should have been tested for blood, whether it was Mr. Ferris's or Mr. Hamler's or a third party, or whether it was not blood at all. I cannot disagree with that, which should have been done. But the standard is that if the police officers follow the normal practice, then that is good faith. Prosecutorial misconduct, essentially what we were doing was asking the jury to use their common sense. They know that the laptop was not tested. We didn't argue, or certainly, I think when you look at the closing arguments and the rebuttal as a whole, neither myself or Mr. Scow made that argument that it was blood, that it was either Mr. Ferris's blood or it was the defendant's blood. Neither one of us made that argument. So if there was a slippage in that Mr. Scow left off red blood-like substance, that's all that it was. Certainly, our intent is never to commit prosecutorial misconduct. That's taken extremely seriously by my office, and by myself in particular. So having learned something from this case, certainly I would let Metro know, hey, when there's something of potential or evidentiary value, and in this case I would argue we don't know whether or not it was inculpatory, certainly it could have been, or exculpatory, they need to preserve that. I think given the situation, knowing that this was the victim's only form of communication and that he needed the laptop back, I think that was a judgment call on that their part, and I think they complied with their normal practices. So I don't think it was bad faith on the part of the police department. Certainly I would submit that there was not prosecutorial misconduct conducted by myself or Mr. Scowen closing argument. When you look at the closing argument and the rebuttal in its totality, to point out one sentence where the prosecutor failed to say blood-like substance or apparent blood-like substance or a red substance, and Mr. Westbrook used magic marker at the end, or in his closing argument, and certainly it could have been magic marker, but that's just not what the jury found.
You want to comment on juror number three? Because you've got a minute left.
Absolutely, Your Honor, I would love to. I was not shocked when the verdict came back, if we're going to talk about personal opinions. Obviously, Mr. Westbrook was shocked. I was not. Not only was the jury polled, we did not request the jury to be pulled. Mr. Westbrook did. It's his recollection that juror number three was sobbing, crying, shaking her head. That was not my recollection. Certainly there was enough of an issue there to where Mr. Westbrook raised it in front of Judge Barker. Judge Barker pulled juror number three again. Then we went on. Every juror said, yes, that was in fact their verdict. That wasn't good enough. We went back and re-polled the entire jury. And that wasn't good enough when juror number three once again stated that that, in fact, was her verdict. Mr. Westbrook asked the court to poll the jury a third time. That's my recollection. Finally, that didn't happen. They'd been polled once. They'd been polled twice. Both times she stated that that was her verdict. It comported with the jury's the verdict. That I don't believe that there was any issue. We have no affidavits or anything of that sort to state otherwise, Your Honor.
Thank you. I think you sufficiently answered.
Thank you very much.
Your time has expired. Rebuttal, Mr. Westbrook. You have 2 minutes and 24 seconds.
Thank you, Judge. This is Ms. Sedlock speaking in her closing argument. I want to talk a little bit about the blood, page 5573, volume 2 of our appendix. And then later on, okay, let's say for the sake of argument, she didn't say for the sake of argument, I'm sorry. Okay, let's say there's no blood on it. Well, the laptop wasn't recovered until the next day. You don't know what the defendant could have done with the laptop in that period. Not only is she saying that there was blood on the laptop unequivocally, when that cannot be proved because of what the police did with the evidence, but she is flipping the burden of proof, which is exactly what she did when she got up and addressed the court during argument. I mean, she flipped the burden at the very start by saying, in reference to our impeachment evidence, there was no evidence Mr. Ferris fabricated any of that. It's irrelevant whether he was a victim. There's no evidence that he fabricated any of that. The defense is not supposed to be presenting evidence.
But how do you get around the argument that the police acted in good faith in returning the computer to the man it desperately needed?
Two ways. Number one, because it's a two-part test. Bad faith is one part. The second part, which hasn't been argued by the state today, is that my client was prejudiced by the loss of the evidence. And it's an or standard, not an and standard. So even if the court finds that the police acted in good faith, which I submit that they didn't because they're told they have to preserve evidence, even if the court finds that they only were negligent or even weren't negligent at all, the fact of the matter is he was prejudiced by the loss. And then the state did get to have their cake and eat it too by sitting there over and over and over again. I mean, Mr. Scow didn't just say it once. He said, it's blood, here, 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 pointing to the picture. Over and over again, they got to say it's blood. And the only thing the court did, they denied our Sanborn instruction, which might have fixed it. They denied that, the court denied that, and the court said blood-like substance. Well, why not say paint-like substance? Would it have been a different verdict if he said paint-like substance? There was a question about why is this an overwhelming case? Why is there overwhelming evidence in this case? And the only response the state's able to give as to why this is not just a he said case is, well, because there was a laptop, and the laptop was in Mr. Hamler's possession.
What about the statement Mr. Hamler allegedly made to the woman before this incident occurred?
After work today, Your Honors, my son's at daycare, I'm going to get him. That's the tone of voice she used. They're taking the words out of context and injecting meaning into them that doesn't exist.
Okay.
That's what this case is all about. As a housekeeping matter, Your Honors, may I submit a copy of the jab so that you can see that there's an error in the transcript or request an official rewrite of the transcript?
I have no problem with that. That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to rule. Thank you. This case will stand submitted. I want to thank Ms. Sedlock and Mr. Westbrook for your spirited argument and your good